length will just mean every object breaks up as a finite direct sum of simple objects. Finally, I want one to be absolutely simple. That is, end of one is k. All right. So these are the kinds of things that we're studying. And the first problem that I want to pose is, can you classify pre-Tanakhian categories? This is probably too hard. There are two major sources prior to this Hartman-Snowden work of where these things can come from other than RepG. One is things that are very similar to RepG. They're called essentially Tanakhian. Tanakhian categories have a forgetful functor to vec. If I have a representation of G, I can just forget it. And if I have a forgetful functor to a category kind of like vec, that is this sort of essentially Tanakhian case. So the main example here is representations of supergroups, but there's also an analog of this in characteristic P. There's a category called verp, and you might study algebraic groups in verp, or you might study algebraic groups in supervector spaces, and these are a slight generalization. But you can also talk about ones that are quite a bit different from that. So there's a theorem of Deligne's that says if C is pre-Tanakhian over C and it has moderate growth. So moderate growth means the length, in the semi-simple case, the number of simples inside x to the n grows no more than exponentially, which would automatically happen if, for example, there was some good notion of integer dimension for your objects. Then C has to be the category representations of a supergroup. And there are some weaker theorems like this in characteristic P that aren't quite as strong as this one, but along those same lines, where you would put ver P instead of supergroup. Are there any others? Yes. There are some examples due to Deligne based on Brouwer and Shervile that are called interpolation categories, where there's something called GLT, where T can be any complex number. And when T is an integer, it's related to GLN, but when T is not an integer, it's not. So I talked a lot about those in the pre-talks. I'm not gonna talk about them much at all today. Instead, I want to talk about a second motivating question. So categories come in two flavors. They can either be concrete categories or not. And what I mean by that is a concrete category, the objects have internal mathematical structure. These are the kinds of categories that you learn about first when you learn about category theory, like the objects are groups and you can talk about elements of that group or subgroups of that, you know, like not just maps between different groups, you can also talk about elements. So RepG is an example of such a thing where the objects have internal structure. You know, another good example is a category of bimodules over the hyperfinite 2-1. These are, you know, various ways you might make a concrete category. These categories like GLT, OT, ST, or like the temporally Leib-Jones categories or Hanvli categories or something like this, the objects are formal. It'll be something like the objects are a bunch of points on a line and the morphisms are some diagrams with certain boundaries. Now, I can't ask like, what are the vectors in an object that's just a formal point? Like, so these don't have any internal mathematical structure. All you do is talk about the morphisms. And that's perfectly fine from some viewpoints, but it's also a little bit annoying. For example, if you want to talk about subobjects, you can't actually talk about a subobject. You have to talk about like a projection map and pretend that that projection map had some image or something like this. So if you are presented with an abstract category, you might wonder, can it be made concrete? Okay, so this is something that subvector people are very familiar with because we often take some abstract category and realize it as bimodules over the hyperfinite. This will not work for something like ST because ST is not unitary. So if we want to make it concrete, we have to go in some completely different direction. So this is the second motivating question. Can Deligne categories be made concrete? Okay, so Hartman-Snowden answer both of these questions. So the answer to question one is that discrete pre-Tanakhian categories, and I'm not going to tell you the definition of discrete, but it includes ST. It does not include OT and GLT. OT and GLT are like algebraic groups in some sense, and ST is like a discrete group in some sense. The definition is basically you're discrete if you have enough Frobenius algebras So there's some good notion of discrete, and they prove that those are almost classified by certain infinite groups together with a kind of measure on those groups. And in particular, ST will come from the group S infinity of infinite permutations together with some measure that I'll talk about at the end of the talk. But this also gives an answer to question two. They build something called rep G mu out of such a group and a measure. And that's a concrete category. It consists of certain modules for a certain algebra. And so you can talk about what is a submodule, and everything is perfectly concrete. The objects are modules. Okay. These were kind of some of the motivating questions, but there's a bonus here, which is that this has led to many new examples, and kind of a lot. There aren't examples of tensor categories can be kind of thin on the ground. You know, for when people, you know, it's like in Hopf algebras, there were only so many examples for like 40 years. Then quantum groups happen, and suddenly there are a bunch of examples. And then there's not much, and then maybe there's a Zumi category, so you get a bunch. And then there's not much, and this is another kind of explosion. So I think this is super exciting, and that's why I wanted to work on this stuff. Okay, so that's the end of my background. Yes?
Are you thinking characteristic zero or?
Yeah, so their theory sometimes works in characteristic P, but not quite as much as you would like. So for the example that I'm going to be focused on in this, it will work in any characteristic. For ST, they're only able to realize ST as rep G mu in the characteristic zero case. Hopefully there's some modifications of this that would work in characteristic P, but it's a little bit harder, yeah.
Will you say something about this measure?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I will also give you a warning, though, which is this measure is not positive, so it's a different sort of measure than what you might be used to. But okay, great. So the first thing I want to do is I want to tell you about this new example, the Delannoy category, and I'm going to do this not from the general theory. We were able to get a pretty concrete combinatorial model, so I'll tell you about our concrete combinatorial model, and then I'll tell you a whole bunch of theorems that we prove about the Delannoy category, and then I'll come back and motivate it from the general viewpoint. Okay, so here's our new example. I'm going to give a combinatorial description of it. So this is not the concrete description. This is an abstract description where I'm just going to tell you about the morphisms. I'm going to take the additive and Kruby envelope of something, which if you're, you know, that just means force it to have direct sums and direct sumands. So the category that I want to start with is has an object that I'm going to call CRN. This name will become apparent later, but for now, all you need to know is that there's one for every non-negative integer n. And the morphisms from RN to RM are spanned, you know, they have a basis given by what are called n by m Delannoy paths. And this is where this Delannoy category terminology came from. It's kind of a common thing in tensor categories to name your category after the sequence that is the dimensions of the Hom spaces. It's like the Fibonacci category or the Fuchs-Catalan category. The Delannoy numbers are the numbers of certain paths, and that's where we came up with this name. So the idea is that this is a 2x3 Delannoy path right here. What you're allowed to do, you can either step in one direction, like happens here, step in the other direction, like happens here, or go diagonally. You're always going to the right or up, okay? And steps of 1, 0, 0, 1, or 1, 1, those are Delannoy paths, okay? So the dimensions of all the Hom spaces are given by the number of these Delannoy paths, which are Delannoy numbers, okay? Now, the fun thing is the formula for composition. So to compose two paths, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a three-dimensional version of a Delannoy path. So a three-dimensional Delannoy path can step in any subset of the three, any non-empty subset of the three directions. Go right, back, up, were any of those diagonals. What you do is you sum over three-dimensional Delannoy paths with the property that they project down to P on two of the coordinates, project down to Q on the other two coordinates, and then you take the third projection and you sum those up with a number out in front, which is just a sign, okay? And that sign is like the length, I didn't write down the formula, but it's like the length of the three-dimensional path minus the length of the R path or something, some easy formula, okay? So let me give you show you an example of this. So here I've written down all three of the Homs from R1 to R1. Those are the 1x1 Delannoy paths. Here I've written down those three again. I want to compose them and I'll get some sums of those as well. And here's the sums that I get. And I just want to explain where that comes from in a few examples. So every time I write down a three-dimensional Delannoy path on the cube, it should explain one of the entries down here, okay? So if I write down this one here, if I project into the X and Y directions, it will look like this. Is that big enough for people to see? Should I zoom in? Let's do that. So if I project into the X and Y direction, I get this picture. If I project into the Y and Z direction, I can't see this, then it goes up and then it goes right, so that's this. And if I project into the XZ direction, it just looks like this. So that's telling me that when I compose this with this, there should be a term with that in the answer. And that's here. The sign is negative. The sign is negative because this has length 3 and this has length 2. And that's where the sign comes from. I could do the same thing here. It's a little hard to see. I'm taking a diagonal path and then a back path. And if you project that down, you'll get this, this, and this. And that will tell you that this guy also appears in that composition, which is that term. Okay. And you just do this for all the 3x3 Delannoy paths, and it will fill out this little composition formula. Okay, so that's how you do composition. Now it's supposed to be a tensor category, and tensoring objects is not bad. Tensoring objects is also described by Delannoy numbers. R to the A, tensor R to the B is a sum of a bunch of other R to the C's, where there's a copy of RC for every time there's an A by B Delannoy path of length C. So that's not bad. The associator is very straightforward, but there is one tough thing, which, did you have a question? No, okay. There is one tough thing, which I'm not gonna tell you, which is how you tensor two morphisms. And there is a good way to describe this, but it involves like four-dimensional Delannoy paths and various projections and, you know, but.
So when you say it's straightforward, do you mean it's trivial or it's actually a non-trivial?
So what I mean is that if I have a AB Delannoy path and a BC Delannoy path, I can construct an ABC three-dimensional one out of it. I think I have that right. No, I want... what do I want? I have A, B, and length of lambda, and then I'm going to have a length of lambda C path. So I have an A, B path of length L of lambda, and then I have a L of lambda C path of a certain thing. I can build out of that a three-dimensional path in some not difficult way, and I can do the same thing for the other way of... Let me not get into the details. What I mean is that there is a bijection between the terms you get from associating one way and the terms you get from associating the other way. And under that bijection, the associator is just the identity on the things that match up. So whether that's trivial or not, it's not quite trivial because the things on the two sides are indexed by different sets, but they are indexed by sets that are in a bijection with each other. So in some sense, they're trivial. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. But yeah, so tensoring morphisms is much harder, and I'm not going to tell you how it goes. So I haven't fully told you the category in an elementary way, but I almost have. Okay. So in this paper, we answer basically every question you could have about the Delannoy path. What the Delannoy category? What are all the simples? What are the rules for decomposing simples? There are certain induction restriction functors that are natural. We completely describe those, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we basically, like any question that we could think of, we have the answer to. So it's pretty well described. And let me tell you first about the simples. So if lambda is a word in two letters, dot and circle, there is an object L lambda, which I'll tell you about in a second, for that word that we construct explicitly. And the theorem is that L lambda is always simple. Two such are simple if and only if they come from the same word. Every simple object is isomorphic to one of these L lambdas. And the length of lambda is telling you for which Rn does that lambda first appear in, okay? So if you look at like, for example, R3, R3 will have a bunch of easy maps to R2. And if you take the joint kernel of those, that's like the new stuff that hasn't appeared yet. That new stuff will be the words of length 3. Okay?
Sorry, I couldn't read the last line.
Yeah, joint kernel of all the natural maps from CRN to CRN minus 1 is the sum over all the ones that have length n. Okay? So the meaning of length is that it's telling you, you know, if you first decompose R1 and then you decompose R2 but forget about the stuff you already know, then you decompose R3 and forget about the stuff that you already know, the stuff that comes up, the new stuff at each level, is the words of length n. And moreover, it's multiplicity free. Each simple corresponding to the word of length n only appears once in the new stuff. Okay. So these are what the simples are. Let me tell you where they can come from. So because I have this eventually I'll tell you a way of thinking about this as a concrete category where I'll actually be able to tell you about subobjects. But for now, all I have is morphisms. So to talk about a subobject, the best way to do it is to tell you about a projection and then just pretend that that projection is a stand-in for the subobject. That's called Kurubi completion. So the projections are not that bad. So the rule is dot means go sort of down around the square, and circle means go up, except in both cases, you're allowed to go diagonally instead if you want. So the projection is basically like a sum here of, so I could go right and then up, or I could go diagonal and then up, or I could go right and then diagonal, or I could go diagonal and then diagonal. So it's
not allowed to go.
Well, that would be, no. Those terms are going to come up from the old stuff.
I see.
Yeah. So I'm not telling you about all the subprojections of R squared. I'm only telling you about the projections on R squared, which are new, and those ones always stay close to the diagonal. Okay?
Is there a simple thing you can say about what's kind of coming combinatorial problem that leads to this classification?
Yeah, I mean, we don't get the classification directly by thinking about Delannoy category, Delannoy paths. You probably could. Like at some point, I'm like, I should just have like a. Sometimes I might want to have a student just do a thesis that is just like, we're never going to talk about oligomorphic groups. We're just going to give a purely combinatorial description of the Delannoy category and prove all the theorems about it that way. That's not what we do in the paper. And I, you know, so in the paper, in fact, we construct these objects as submodules using this concrete description. But it's not at all hard to check that these are projections. In fact, that was how I first guessed these formulas, via projections and not via subobjects. Yeah.
these diagrams, you can see them as kind of like the counterpart of these diagrams with the dots and lines for RFST, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it should somehow, there should be, I don't know exactly, yeah, it should be analogous to certain things for RFST. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In some sense, they're less complicated, maybe, but I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Great. So we know the fusion rules. They're given by what we call a ruffle product, which is a modified version of a shuffle product. So a shuffle product, you would take two words and look at all ways of shuffling them together. So the first one should stay in order, and the second one would stay in order, but you know nothing about the order in between them. This is a modified version of that, where you also allow letters to collide, and there's certain rules for what happens when the letters collide. Okay, so for example, if I want to take L dot with L dot circle, I can put the dot, I can shuffle them. So either the dot goes first, the dot goes second, or the dot mixes in third. That's the easy part. And then for the ruffles, this dot could collide with this dot. And the rule is if they're the same color and they collide, you just get one copy of that dot. So that would give you this, okay? But if they're opposite colors and they collide, they can become either color or nothing, okay? So if this dot collides with here, it can become either an open, a closed, or nothing at all, okay? And that's the rule. You kind of need that nothing at all, because otherwise your category won't have duals. Like the, you know, it's important every object has to have some dual object that when I tensor with it, I get the trivial. And that's going to come from the case where just everything collides and you pick nothing at each of those steps. Okay? Any questions about how that?
Does every object of such kind self-dual?
I'll tell you that on the next page. Or not, in two pages. Okay. Yeah, I put something here that I can't really describe because I didn't tell you about induction restriction. Well, let me just tell you, the Grothendieck ring of this is very nice. It has a Hopf algebra structure for reasons that are kind of interesting, but which in the order that I'm giving this talk, maybe if this was not supposed to be here, maybe I'll come back to that at the end if I have time. This Grothendieck ring is particularly nice. If you tensor with Q, it will be a polynomial algebra. It's a polynomial algebra in the generators corresponding to certain words. So there are things called Linden words that kind of don't repeat themselves. And if you take just the ones corresponding to Linden words, then this will be a polynomial algebra. So the Grothendieck ring is very nice. Yeah, so the Hopf algebra structure comes from, there's a restriction functor from this category to it tensor itself. And seeing what that restriction does, I'll come back to why that exists later, but seeing what that restriction does gives you this Hopf algebra structure. And we can do a bunch of other things. So for example, I told you before that if I decompose Rn, the new stuff appears with multiplicity 1, but you might also wonder, how often does the old stuff appear? And the answer is that a word lambda appears with multiplicity n choose the length of lambda. So that's a nice formula. Here's your question about duals. You keep the word in the same order, but you interchange the two kinds of dots. That way, you really do get one, the trivial object, which corresponds to the empty word, coming from just make everything collide. There's some other fun stuff. There are these things called Adams operators, which are, if you were looking at the category of representations of a group, these are the things on the Grothendieck group is like the class functions. There's an operation on class functions which replaces chi with chi of g to the n for some fixed n, and these are the Adams operators. And for us, the Adams operations are trivial, which is kind of interesting. This doesn't happen for any other known categories, I think. Maybe OSP 1/2, No, I think it doesn't happen for anything. Yeah. So for groups, this is like saying, if it were a group, this would be like saying that every element is conjugate to all of its powers, which never happens for finite groups, for example, because your element has some order. And if I take that power, it's definitely not conjugate to it. Okay. So the atoms operations are trivial. And using the atoms operations, we're able to calculate what Schur functors do. And every Schur functor actually breaks up as a sum of wedge powers. So kind of wedge powers are the only interesting Schur functor here. And S mu will break up as a sum of wedge powers with some multiplicities. These multiplicities are very nice combinatorially. They're the number of surjective tableau. So you fill the Young diagram mu with the numbers 1 through I, but every number has to appear. Surjective semi-standard, no. Semi-standard Young tableau, right? Because otherwise they can't have repeat. Yeah, so you count the number of semi-standard Young tableau where every number 1 through I appears, and that's that multiplicity. So for example, sim squared breaks up as wedge squared plus V for any V in this category. So these are the kind of things that we can prove. We also prove certain things about some induction and restriction, and we understand basically everything there is to say about the category. And moreover, this category has some highly novel properties. So I already told you about one of them, that the atoms operations are trivial. It does not come from supergroups because the growth rate is too big. But it also provably doesn't come from any kind of Dalin interpolation. There's no ultra product of groups construction that will get you this category. So it's genuinely new. In characteristic P, so everything that I did works in every characteristic and uniformly, like the simples look the same in every characteristic. And in characteristic P, it's the first example of a semi-simple pre-Tanakian category that does not have finite growth. Okay, great. So that's, yeah. So
finite growth meant sub-exponential?
Yeah. Finite is the wrong word here. What did I call this?
That's all right.
But I should, it's sub-exponential. There's another word, moderate. That's what people call it, moderate growth.
Is it known precisely what the growth is?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways. You can, right, so if you're counting length, yeah, it's, okay, so when you tensor C1 with C1, right, if you keep tensoring C1, what you'll get is you'll get n factorial, you'll get n factorial copies of Cn and a bunch of smaller stuff. And so it's at least factorial just from counting like how many times Cn appears in some big tensor power of C1.
What I'm thinking is perhaps like a notion of amenability of this category. Maybe this kind of prevents it from.
Yeah, that's a good question, probably. Which is interesting though, because it's going to have some kind of measure. And there's some interesting remark in the paper you might want to look. If you go to their paper, which is 140 pages long, if you search for amenable, there's one remark that talks about amenability, and there's an interesting question there. Okay, so this is our category. We can say all sorts of stuff about it. It satisfies a bunch of new properties, but where does it come from? Okay. All right. And I should say, these new properties were already in their first paper. They knew this category had some weird properties. They just didn't know much about it concretely. And the new paper was to just say everything about what the category looked like. OK, so what I want to do in the rest of the talk is tell you a little bit about the Harman-Snowden theory so that you can see where this category comes from. OK, so, and this is tensor categories coming from oligomorphic groups together with measures. And so I'm going to have to tell you what a oligomorphic group is and what a measure is, okay? So the idea here is you start with a group like S infinity or automorphisms of the real line. You define a category of permutation representations using a measure on G. And I will say a little bit more about this. But these are, there's going to be an object for every G set. But I don't just want the maps of G sets. I want the maps of the corresponding permutation representations. So I'm going to try to build something that looks like the category of permutation representations. And this is going to require a measure in order to compose. Okay? So if I look at a HOM between two permutation representations and I try to compose it with another HOM, I'm going to have to do some convolution. And that convolution is going to depend on measuring sizes of certain things. And so I'm going to need a measure. And then step three is kind of the most mysterious, and I will not talk much at all about it in this talk, but I want to take an abelian envelope. And sometimes this abelian envelope is something that they call rep G mu, which is a concrete category. Okay? This is some category of modules for a certain, they're like the nice modules of a certain completed group algebra. And this completion requires the convolution goes into the construction of the algebra structure on this completion, and so it uses the measure. But there's a concrete category of modules for an actual algebra called rep g mu, and under nice circumstances, rep g mu will give you this abelian envelope. Now, there might be other cases where a more complicated construction gives you an abelian envelope, unclear. And the most general version of step three is still open. Under certain strong conditions, to go from two to three, I can just take Cauchy completion. I can just take Kurubian and additive completion. And so in these strong conditions, it's sort of a Mashke's theorem. There are a bunch of numbers that come up in the theory, and if they're all non-zero, then your category will be semi-simple, and you could just do this. Okay, so this is the vague idea. Let me say a little bit more about what groups. So oligomorphic permutation groups are studied in model theory. They're an old topic in model theory, but they happen to come up here. They're when you have a group G acting on a set omega, such that when you have G act on n tuples of elements in omega, there's always only finitely many orbits. And we'll always use the word finitary to mean acting with finitely many orbits. And this is going to be important because the HOMs from one permutation representation to another permutation representation are, there's a basis for it consisting of certain orbits for the action on X, like the G orbits on X cross Y. And so what I want is that G orbits of products of things, there should only be finitely many of them to enforce that my HOM spaces are finite dimensional when I look at perm G. Okay, so that's the key thing. In fact, it's not important that G is oligomorphic. The oligomorphic depends on the set omega. You can instead just say G is a group with a certain topology where the basic open subgroups are the stabilizers of points in omega to the n, and then you can forget omega. So it's not really a property of the permutation representation. There are these things they call admissible groups, which are groups with a certain nice topology, and you can actually do the whole construction for an admissible group. This includes oligomorphic and pro-oligomorphic groups, but the important thing is that this data of omega is not actually essential to the construction. Really, all you need is the group.
Oligomorphic, actually.
Yeah, it's the same root as oligarch. So it is a group that is is controlled by the few. So because everything has finitely many orbits, you can understand the whole action is encoded in just a small number of things. And so that's the meaning. Yeah. Good question. Other questions? All right. So the key idea here is that in order to do composition of maps, you need to understand the restrictions to open subgroups. Like you need to understand the kinds of sets that are going to come up when we do convolution product will no longer necessarily be G sets. They'll be H sets for H some subgroup of G. Okay, like a stabilizer or something like this. So we also want to be able to think about these open subgroups. And the interesting thing is the only sets that are going to come up are sets that are acted on by some subgroup. But I'm going to want to be able to talk about the size of that set independent of the subgroup. So they have this notion, a G hat set is a set that has an action of some open subgroup, but the choice of open subgroup is not part of the data. Okay? Shrinking the subgroup doesn't change the G set, the G hat set. Okay? So to define perm G mu, what's going to happen is the objects are formal symbols called vec X, where X is a finitary and smooth G set. So finitary means GX with finitely many orbits, and smooth means the stabilizers are open subgroups. So in particular, omega, if G is oligomorphic, omega will be smooth and finitary, and every power of omega will be smooth and finitary. Okay? But also, for example, the n element subsets, as opposed to the n tuples, the n element subsets will also be finitary and smooth G set. Okay? All right. The morphisms, Homs from X to Y, are G invariant things that they call X by Y matrices. So these are functions on X cross Y, which are what they call Schwarz functions. That is, they should be smooth and have finitary support. Okay, so they should have finitary support. That is to say, they should only achieve finitely many different values. And the what does smooth mean here? It means that the stabilizer of E, like. It means that the sets, the level sets, are open. I think that's the statement.
Are these Schwarz functions the usual Schwarz functions in analysis?
No, but they are inspired by, the name comes from that. I mean, they are closely related, yeah. All of this, a bunch of these constructions in this section are kind of inspired by constructions in p-adic analysis, so it's related to appearance of Schwarz functions there, I think. Okay, and there's a rule for how to compose, which is where the measure comes in, which is that if I want to compose an X by Y matrix with a Y by Z matrix, what I do is I integrate them against some measure. Okay, so the idea is that And this is going to be particularly easy because everything has finitary support. When I say integrate with respect to a measure, I just mean break it up into the finitely many spots where both of them are constant. For each of those, multiply the two numbers that those functions achieve, and then multiply by the measure of whatever the set is that they agree on, which is going to be a nice, is going to be a G hat set. That's the important thing. Okay. All right. I think I'm going to skip the construction of rep G mu I put in this slide because there were a bunch of questions about this at my pre-talk, but maybe I will skip it for now. I can come back if you want. But there is a construction of a certain completed group algebra using Schwarz functions that'll have some convolution product, and rep G omega is rep G mu is the category of smooth A modules. I don't really want to get into this. Maybe I will say one thing, which is that this notation C of X, C is the Schwarz functions on X, and this abelian envelope functor sends a permutation representation to the module of all Schwarz functions on that representation. So that's why when I was talking about the objects, I called them CRN instead of RN, okay. But I don't want to get into this. Okay, great. So I want to tell you about examples now. I'm going to tell you about two examples. One is the S infinity example, and the other is the example, the Delannoy example, okay? So these measures have to satisfy certain extremely natural conditions that I'm not going to write down, but none of them will be a surprise to you. The most interesting one is a multiplicativity in fibers property that says if I take a transitive G hat set and it takes a map from another transitive G hat set, then the size of the total set is the size of the base set times the size of the fiber. And all the fibers will have the same size by the fact that it's a transitive G action. All those fibers will be conjugate to each other, and so they'll have the same measure, okay? So I did this example in the pre-talk, but let me do it again. One of the axioms says the measure of a point. So a point is a G hat, so here I'm looking at S infinity, I'm looking at omega squared inside S infinity. I'm looking at omega squared as an S infinity set. All of these subsets that are shaded in particular ways are G hat subsets. So for example, this one is preserved by the permutation, the open subgroup that only permutes these guys. So if I take the open subgroups of stuff that only permute 4 and higher, that sends this to itself, in fact, acts on it trivially, and so that is a G hat set. Okay, similarly, this is fixed again by that subgroup. This one is fixed by, again, everything 3 and bigger. Okay? All right, so these are all G hat sets. One of the axioms is that the measure of a point is 1. And the other thing that I'm going to do, I'm just going to declare T to be the measure of omega, okay? And what I claim is that there's a unique measure that assigns, for every number T, there exists a unique measure that assigns T to omega. And rather than proving that, I'm just going to tell you how to read it off in this example. So one of the axioms says that the point has size 1, so this guy definitely has size 6. One of them says that it's finitely additive. So this guy is just omega, and so this one has to have size t minus 3. Here, I could do the same thing, but I'm going to first use that I have some kind of product structure here, or fibers, to say that this whole thing has size 2t, which means this part has size 2t minus 5. Okay. This one is isomorphic to all of the things 3 and higher, and so it again has size t minus, or sorry, all the things 2 and higher, so it again has size t minus 2. And this one, I have to use this multiplicative and fibers property, so this guy fibers down to here, so it has size t minus 2, times size t minus 1, that's what I wrote here, t minus 2 times t minus 1, but then I have to subtract off the diagonal, and this will give me some size. So you can sort of see from this that you can work out that there exists a unique measure. And in fact, it has a nice formula, so what they prove, there exists a unique measure, mu t, with mu t omega being t, and it has a formula, which is that if you take any g hat set, let Sn be the subgroup fixing the first n things. If you look at the number of fixed points for the action of Sn and let n vary, it eventually becomes polynomial. And the measure is plug t into that polynomial. Okay? And what they prove is that if the characteristic is 0, then this completed group algebra construction recovers Deligne's St as a concrete category. All right.
Is it known to not be true if the characteristic is P?
Yeah, if the characteristic is P, it does not quite work. Yeah, unfortunately. Okay. All right, I wanted to do one calculation so you can see that this, like, this convolution composition is actually super easy to compute. So Hom's from omega to omega, that should have a basis that's given by the S infinity orbits on omega cross omega. There are two orbits. the one where the two coordinates are equal and the one where the two coordinates are not equal. I can compose those. If I want to compose delta x equals y with delta y equals z, I just integrate. So I want to know, what are all the y that are equal to x and equal to z? Well, there's either none of them if x and z are distinct, or there's a single point if x and z are equal, and the measure of a single point is 1, so I just get delta x equals z. So it's easy to see that delta x equals y is an identity. That tells me these three entries. And the only interesting one is this one, where I compose delta x not equal to y with delta y not equal to z. Now I'm integrating over all the y's that are not x and not z. And I have to be careful. If x and z are the same, that's t minus 1 possibilities, right? It's saying that you're looking at omega minus a single point. And if x and y are different from each other, then I've removed 2 points, and that measure is t minus 2. Okay, so I get t minus 1, which is the measure of omega minus x, or t minus 2, which is the measure of omega minus x and z, times each of those delta functions. Okay, so that's the rule for composition. This agrees with one of the definitions of ST. You could go and work out things like, what is the formula for the projection in terms of delta x equals y and delta x not equal to y, and it has some formula. Okay. Any questions about that? Do you feel like you could go home and compute, like write down a basis for Homs from omega, like three-element subsets of omega to three-element subsets of omega, and start composing them by just counting the sizes of these sets? It's not bad. You can, you know. Yeah. Like, I could teach a math camp class on this, where I would not talk about, you know, any like completed group algebras, but I did teach people how to do compositions of how to do these kinds of integrals. It's not bad. Okay. I wanted to talk very briefly about this concrete version. Remember where I said I can think of short functions on omega as modules for some completed group algebra. I'm not gonna tell you what that completed group algebra is, but I can at least tell you what the submodules are. So there should be two submodules corresponding to, there was a two-dimensional algebra that looked like C plus C. What are the submodules? One of them is the constant functions, and the other one is the functions with total size, with total integral zero. Okay, these are the two submodules. So you really can talk about concrete submodules. Now, you have to be a little bit careful. If you don't understand what the completion is, it's not obvious that these are submodules, right? I have to check that these are not just preserved under the action of G, which is obvious, but also that it's preserved under like the action of the completed group algebra, which involves saying that certain integrals don't leave you from these submodules, but it works, okay? And you can check. Go home and compose. Take any function of integral zero, compose it with the projection on the previous page, and see that it gives you one. And if the thing doesn't have integral zero, then it gives you zero. Okay, great. So let me finish quickly by talking about where this comes from in the Delannoy case. The automorphisms of R greater than are an oligomorphic group. So this is order-preserving automorphisms of the real line. So it's an enormous group. The open subsets look like GA, the subsets fixing some finite set A inside R. Those subgroups actually look like a bunch of copies of the group, right? If I fix 2 points, that's 3 copies of the group. So this is where these restriction functors that I alluded to earlier came from. I have a restriction functor from G to the subgroup of things fixing my favorite point, which is G cross G, okay? Those are the open subsets. Now, the G hat sets inside powers of R look like certain polyhedra inside, this was inside R2, but I could look at R3 or R4. That's what the G hat sets look like. And there's a measure that satisfies all the right properties, which is Euler characteristic, but you have to be a little bit careful. These polyhedra might not include all of their edges or all their vertices, and you have to keep that in mind when you compute the Euler characteristic. So this is like a triangle missing its top edge. So it has one vertex, this one, two edges, these ones, and one face. And so its Euler characteristic is zero. Okay? And this again has all the nice properties. So I get a pre-Tanakian concrete category rep G out of this. Let me just end with one calculation. What is Homs from vec R to vec R? Well, that should be the G invariant functions on R cross R. Now there are three of those because X could be smaller than Y, X could be equal to Y, or X could be bigger than Y. Okay? Those are the three orbits of G on R cross R. So I have, this is going to be spanned by three things, the characteristic function of X less than Y, X equal to Y, and X greater than Y. I don't know why I used chi on this slide and delta two slides ago, but you know. These correspond combinatorially to these three paths. That's where this path model came from. And let's check one of our calculations. If I want to compose A with B, so I'm going to do an interesting one. That's the integral over all possible Y of A of XY, B of YZ, integrate with respect to Euler characteristic. That's the measure, because both of these were just one when it works. So I just look at the measure of the set where both of them were one. It's the measure of the set of Y where Y is bigger than X and bigger than Z, right? This one says Y is bigger than X. This one says Y is smaller than Z, okay? So it's all the things where Y is bigger than both X and Z. That is always, depending upon which of X and Z is bigger, it's always an open interval going off to infinity, right? And so the measure of that is 0 minus 1 plus 0 is minus 1. So what I get is if I compose A with B, I get the function that is minus 1 everywhere, which is minus the sum of all three of my characteristic functions, right? The identity function minus 1 is a sum of the function that's minus 1 on x less than y, minus 1 on x equal to y, and minus 1 on x greater than y. And you can compare this to our composition rule here, where this guy composed with this guy was a sum of all three of those with a minus. Okay, so I think I'm out of time, so I will stop there.
Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Is this a good time to go back to the K-group?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you mean this...
Here's how you define the generator.
Sorry, so this Grundy group you're asking about? Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah.
So, did I not talk about the sub-objects today? Yeah, I didn't. What exactly do you want to know about this?
I'm just curious about how you define the
generator. How do I turn this into some function?
Yeah,
so this says, one coordinate is X, the other coordinate is Y, and the steps are telling you what order this should be a map from R2 to R parentheses 2 to R parentheses 2. R parentheses 2 are unordered subsets of the real line of size 2. They're unordered, but the real line is ordered. So that is to say, they inherit the correct ordering. So what do? I want to give you a function on R parentheses 2 cross R parentheses 2, that is given an x1 that's smaller than x2 and a y1 that's smaller than y2, I want to tell you what order they all go in. And this one means the first thing you see is x1, the second thing you see is y1, the third thing you see is y2, and the last thing you see is x2. This one would mean the first thing you see is x1 and y1 happening simultaneously. The second thing you see is y2, and the last thing you see is x2. So it is the characteristic function for that. It's the function that is 1 if x1 equals y1, both of which are smaller than y2, which they automatically will be, and y2 is smaller than y3. So the projections turn out to be like x1 is either less than or equal to or greater than or equal to y1, which is less than x2, which is less than or greater than or equal to y2, which is less than, et cetera. And all those less than or equal to's is why I get 4 terms here instead of a smaller number of terms. Does that answer the question? Great. Other questions?
Do you have a basis for the simple modules?
A basis for the simple modules.
The Hom space from C of Rn to the simple
Not in the case where it's multiplicity 1 because it's the new guy, or not?
Well, I mean,
yeah. Yeah, what do we have? I mean, the trick that is often used is that we have a basis for the GA co-invariance for things of length A. That's often the trick that's used, but you just want to know, do I have a basis for maps from, if I have a projection, do I, oh, but yeah, if I.
Like, right, what I mean, the kind of technical term for this is cellular structure. Way of kind of taking C of Rn to C of Rm.
Yeah.
And saying, like, okay, I can break this up into things factoring through all these smaller symbols.
Yeah.
Canonical way of writing it as a Hom twist.
Yeah. I don't think we do, but it should be possible, and it's going to be kind of how far do you stray from the diagonal. Like, if you're on the maps that go to the new things, stay very close to the diagonal. In that case, we do kind of have that argument, but for the lower ones that factor through lower stuff, that's going to somehow be related to straying further from the diagonal, but I don't know exactly how one would phrase it.
You know, going further from the diagonal means you have kind of longer straight pieces.
Yeah.
About, like, shortening that.
Yeah, it's a good question. That's a good question. We did not do it this way.
For example, in the group algebra of SN,
yeah,
there's a way of, like, picking a basis where you kind of have, you know, the basis corresponds to pairs of tableau.
Yeah.
You can really write it as a product of something corresponding to one tableau and something corresponding to the other tableau.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for, is like an RSK kind of.
That's a good question.
Like, write the, you know, I know.
Yeah.
Sum of the Hom space from Rn to itself is a sum of squares.
Yep, exactly.
How do I write it in terms of pairs of things?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, we don't answer that. That's a great question. Don't know everything about it. You're right. Are there anything else?
There are great group versions of this, which are then graded.
That's a great question. So the question was, are there braided versions of this? So for ST, I know that there are no braided deformations. I have a student writing this up right now. But it's true. There's no braided deformations of ST. This is, like, my favorite problem, is whether Delannoy has a braided deformation. I have some ideas for how to approach it, and I have a student who might work on it. If I were the betting part of me wants to bet that discrete pre-Tanakhian categories never have interesting braided deformations. So I don't have any evidence for this other than the fact that ST doesn't have them. But I mean, this would be some discrete version of Akhmianov rigidity. Now, of course, it's a little weird because they do have you can deform the measure, right? So of course ST has some deformations, but they stay symmetric. So maybe, you know, anyway, I don't know. But yeah, as far as I don't know a braided version, there are some ideas in this direction. I think I know how I could attack it, but I have not done so, but yeah. Yeah, I should say there's a, I mean, if you like graphical calculus, you might ask, is there a graphical calculus for the Delannoy category? And the answer is yes, there is a very nice one that you can extract, not from our paper, you need the appendix of a recent paper of Sophie Kritz. But if you use that, you can write down a nice generators and relations diagrammatic description. And it is based on trivalent vertices with two arrows in and one out, or one in and two out, as opposed to like SL3 where they would all come in or all go out. So yeah, so but you know, there is an interesting diagrammatics here. And so you could try to see, is there a braided version of that diagrammatics? And yeah, I like this question, but I have not made any progress on it yet. Yep. Anything else? Yeah.
I guess this is a shot at the dark type of question, but with all these Schwarz functions,
yeah.
Are there any parallels with these categories? And so like, for the higher non-commutative tori, so these are like irrational rotation algebras and stuff like this, the modules are classified by the, essentially you can realize them as Schwarz functions and some are to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the symbols look a lot alike, like you were showing. Are there any parallels between, this is work by Riefel.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah, I don't know when I don't know anything about that work, so I can't.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Do you have some applications to physics, even trivial ones?
Yeah, it's I don't know any applications to physics. I mean, did OT and ST already even don't really appear as far as I know?
Kuyu told me he was he's
large,
right?
Yeah. Twisted from actual real values of t.
I guess I don't know. Yeah, I think instead of like asking what does it mean to take limit as n goes to infinity of a vertex algebra, you just say like I define this vertex algebra over every t.
Yeah.
Somehow you want to make transformations as a key this was like.
Yeah, I don't know, but my first instinct would be you look at if ST comes up somewhere, then you could wonder whether the Delannoy category comes up in some version of that where things have an ordering. Somehow this is like an analog of ST where ST involves unordered sets, this involves ordered sets. You could imagine that you take some situation that ST comes in and then you somehow impose an ordering in some way, and then the Delannoy category could come up. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I just have a question about like, do you, in these examples, can you compute things like derived endomorphisms of objects?
Everything's semi-simple in this example, so we don't know. There is a modified version of this where you use the circle instead of the line, and we have a paper on that called the circular Delannoy category. That one's not semi-simple, and then we do get into this kind of question, and we can compute everything in that case. Well, there we don't compute the tensor product rules, but we compute everything about stuff like X. You should be able to read off from what's in there.
Yeah, I'm just thinking if you can compute derived endomorphism algebra, that algebra, like say of identity, and if turn out to be a Poisson algebra.
Yeah.
Then
yeah, but for
it seems like the category should have a deformation.
Yeah.
Some
yeah, but for finite, there's for semi-simple categories, the at, like derived endomorphisms are just endomorphisms. Yeah.
Yes.
So there's nothing. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you also mentioned in one of your slides that you want to get the third step is that you want to get the abelian envelope.
Yeah.
Something about that sometimes taking the Grove completion doesn't always work.
Right. So the theorem is, so you can think of indices as subgroups as being the measure of the G set G mod H. And if the indices vanish for every pair of subgroups, or sorry, the indices are non-zero for every pair of subgroups, that's a Mashke's theorem, and then that's when it works.
Okay.
Yep.
And do you know if there are graded deformations of this
number? Yeah, I don't know anything more about. Maybe we better stop because I feel like we're running over time. I'll still be here.
Question.
Yeah. I was just, sorry, what are you at? You want to know if there's braided deformations of?
Of the envelope.
I mean, again, in the semi-simple case, there's no difference between a deformation of the envelope and the deformation of the thing you started with, because deformations of semi-simple things are semi-simple, and so you can still do the Cauchy completion. Yep. All right.